Aslan is a lion. The lion. The great lion. Ooh, said Susan. I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you.
We've come now probably to the episode that people have been waiting for. We're talking about C.S. Lewis and fiction. This is Cole Fakes. I'm joined by Ben Williams and Terry Fakes. As we make our way through the life and literature of C.S. Lewis, the Chronicles of Narnia, of which this quote is just so illustrative and so maybe overquoted today, is the perfect way to begin a discussion on C.S. Lewis, the fiction writer. So, guys, we've talked about C.S. Lewis as an apologist. We've talked about his life. Now we've come to what he's probably best known for, which is his fiction writing. And I just want to point out here at the beginning how odd it is in some ways that you have someone of the towering intellect like C.S. Lewis, somebody who is not only just a great apologist, but a great scholar in his own right, enshrined in some ways in the high ivory tower of academia, who is probably best known now for writing children's stories. And that combination is just not seen in very many people. But Lewis does this at a level that is the bar for someone who's able to channel the deepest truths and scholarly insights with accessible, readable, delightful children's books. And so as we move through his life, I think one of the things that's worth mentioning is the circumstances that surrounded him writing fiction. It was something that spanned almost his entire life, and then his output was just a very small window of his life.
Yeah, if I was reading the other day from his introduction to Paradise Lost, which is very academic, and I thought, if this man had walked up to me and said, I'm thinking about writing a book for children, I would have told him to rethink his choices. That maybe was not the genre for him. And yet he pulls it off and he does it so well. He's not even writing in his own genre, whether it's scholarly or, you know, he's a student of medieval and classic literature. But he's not writing that. He definitely draws from all that, but he finds this ability to speak. He writes science fiction. He writes for children. He does all these different things, and he does it well, which is just incredible. For any of us amateur writers, you just awe at what he's able to accomplish in so many different areas.
You know, I wonder if his fiction came from a different well, because I'm like you, Ben. I did not come to C.S. Lewis through his fiction. It was actually the last thing of his that I read. And from my view, you know, he's got the academic Lewis and his interest in more intellectual side of myth and so forth. But, you know, the circumstances of this, thinking about World War II, and you know that during the Blitz or before the Blitz on London, they sent children, you know, in mass to the countryside. And while Lewis had no kids, I mean, he wasn't a kid person particularly, he ends up with, you know, these children out in the countryside and staying with families. And I think that was a spark. And I think in a sense, it reminded him of his world of imagination when he was a child. In fact, this is a paraphrase, not a quote, but he talked about growing up without imagination is the worst form of poverty, if you will, that children need imagination and living in an imaginary world. And I wonder if the World War II and the children, and then that tapped the well of his imagination as a child, perhaps that's what started him down the road of fiction.
Yeah, so Lewis follows this interesting life course where during World War II, when he becomes internationally well-known, his career really takes off, at least his writing really takes off, and his personal life really declines. As we talked about in that final episode about his life, this is the season of his life in the late 1940s where Mrs. Moore's health is declining. His teaching load is getting to be nearly unbearable. His brother Warney is an alcoholic. In fact, he's hospitalized at the end of in March of 1949. And it's in the middle of this, actually in August of 1949, that he signs this contract to write these kids' books. Now, one interesting thing is, while he's best known for the Chronicles of Narnia, which were written between 1949 and 1956, This is not his first foray into fiction. And before this, actually, right at the end of World War II, he writes the Space Trilogy. In fact, the first one comes out before World War II, and then the others come out during and slightly after. The Screwtape Letters, I don't know if we really consider that a fiction work. I mean, it is fictional, but maybe more of a Christian kind of devotional work, comes out in 1942. The Great Divorce, which is fiction, but again, really dealing with these truths about the Christian life, comes out in 1945. And then it isn't until 1950 that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe comes out. Of course, it's written first, and then The Last Battle comes out in 1956. So like I said, you've got this kind of expansive period of his life where he's thinking about fiction, and then really a total of about 7 books in 7 years where his great works of fiction, The Chronicles of Narnia, are written and published.
He's definitely a student of literature and brings all of that to bear with his life experience with these children. He writes a text at one point in life titled On Writing and Writers. And in that, he talks about the process of writing and who your target audience is. And I thought I'd just read this paragraph. He says, "Not long ago, I saw in some periodical article the statement that children are a distinct race. Something like this seems to be inwardly assumed by many who write today, and still more those who criticize what are called children's books. The theory does not seem to me to be born of facts. For one thing, there is no literary taste common to all children. We find among them all the same types as ourselves. Some read realistic books, some read fantasies, some read Marvel, some read informative books, some read silly success stories. All the books that grown-up people like, and all the good children's books of history, all the successful children's books are rigorously read by adults with the same interest and thoughts as a child might." And here's the great quote: "If you want to write a good book, do not limit it with age." And so he had this such a robust understanding of what literature accomplishes that was so deeper than even the popular level understanding of marketing to a particular age group. And he said, "No, you just need to write a great story." And then having that experience with children just kind of prompted him to do something maybe he hadn't tried before, which was to take his inner imaginary life, a different version of it, and just explore that in a way that children would enjoy, but of course that he obviously did as well as an adult.
If you remember back in our first episode, we talked about this was something that Lewis had with him his entire life. And I think one of the reasons he's such a strong advocate for children, I mean, he never puts them down or talks about them in a diminutive way. Instead, he expresses, I think, what was deeply inside of his own mind and his own heart from childhood on. You'll remember he was creating these worlds of talking rabbits and animals and creatures as a kid. And in some ways, it wasn't that that was escapism, although he was doing this during some difficult times. Instead, I think what was happening is this was Lewis's way of understanding reality. And so there's a way in which you could tell a story that's truer than if we were to just explain a series of events that actually happened. We can capture something truer by telling a story about it. And what Lewis was doing from childhood on was he was interpreting and presenting, providing a window on reality through these stories. And so in some ways, what Lewis is doing is he's talking about the real world in these fantasy worlds. Now, one, you know, with a nod to Lewis here, one thing we have to say is he's talking about the real world through these fantasy worlds, but he's not doing allegory. Is that correct?
I think we need to mention that because he was insistent that he was not doing allegory. And you can see why so many commentators and readers think this is an allegory. And what I mean by that is an allegory is where every character and the circumstances of the story are intended from the beginning to have a corresponding person in real life. So, for example, you could have Aslan the lion is a Christ figure, and that is true. But you're really hard-pressed to look at all the other characters and get them to fit into a Bible story, for example. And so, you know, one of the things, Cole, that's amazing to me, you guys, is that he didn't really start out with these as a story. An allegory starts out as, well, I want to tell the story of Jesus, but I want to do it with different characters. He didn't start out that way. I have read that he began these with a single picture in his head, and then work to flesh out the story. And that would be anything but allegory.
Yeah, there's a subtle but important difference there. And I think it was actually in Lewis's review of Lord of the Rings, where he points out the difference between allegory and myth. Allegory, like you said, is I'm telling actually another story, and I'm using these characters to correspond to it and shed a different light on it. Whereas myth takes something that is true, an image, you know, like Lewis does with these books, and expands what is best or what is worst about humanity and details it. So it takes something, instead of saying, you know, this is a, we think like the Wizard of Oz, for example, has all these characters that line up with different historical figures, and it tells that story. Instead, what myth would do is take something like love and help you explain it and understand it in a better way. And so, like I said, there's a subtlety to this in what's being done, but actually that fits, whether it's the Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia, much better. What Lewis is trying to do is take certain themes, certain things that exist out there in the world or in the world of ideas, and tease them out and put them in characters and events and in a story that helps us actually understand them all the better. And so Aslan would be the perfect example of that. Aslan is a Christ figure in the sense that he helps us to understand what Christ does. But Aslan is not an allegory for Jesus Christ in that he follows his exact life and does all the same things. He rises from the right. dead. But that's to teach us about the character and certain points about the life of Jesus.
I would love to have had this conversation with Lewis, because I do struggle to see the distinction between something that seems pretty allegorical but is not an allegory, but he is the fiction expert, and if he says it's not an allegory, then it's not. But it is definitely a use of fiction that flaunts all the normal boundaries that we have. And Jesus does the same thing. A parable is clearly fictional in the sense of it's not a historical narrative. And yet it's more true than a lot of history you might read, that parables are not strictly speaking allegories with a one-to-one correspondence. And yet it's very easy to draw correspondences from parables of Jesus to people and places. When you read the book of Revelation, you know, the line gets even blurrier, where it's clearly not like the book of Acts, where you're just reading a historical, straightforward narrative. And yet, if I were to call Revelation fiction, I might get into some trouble. I mean, it's kind of a different category. Are there allegories in Revelation? Probably. Is it an allegory? Not exactly. And so I think Lewis probably understood better than I do the contours of the genres of fiction and how they could be used and how the Bible even uses them in a way that he thought he could do as well.
I think that's a good point. I would make this observation, and this is what helped me on this. I'm not rebutting what you're saying, because I do think it's easy to see allegory. But I wonder if, in Lewis's case, he comes to these stories, these ideas, and he comes with a worldview. He comes with a certain framework. And it is not surprising to me that this Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe started out as a story in which he had a picture in his head of a fawn out in a snowy landscape with an umbrella and some packages. And now it takes off and becomes a story. But I would expect the contours of that story to reflect what Lewis believed. And to some extent, it is going to be a little bit allegorical, because it's going to reflect his categories of thought. So I may be splitting hairs there, but it seems to me he came, if it is allegorical, he came at it the wrong way around.
Yeah. He writes in a letter in 1961 that there was an outline of sorts to the Narnia books, but he didn't necessarily start with the outline. In fact, in another letter, he writes to a child had asked, what's the right order to read them in, which we may debate later. And he tells the child, there may not be a right order. And yet in this other letter, he outlines that the magician's nephew is about creation and how evil enters Narnia, so creation and fall. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is about the crucifixion and resurrection. Prince Caspian is about the restoration of true religion after corruption. The Horse and His Boy is about the calling and conversion of a heathen. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he says, is about the spiritual life, especially in Reepicheep. The Silver Chair is about the continuing war with the powers of darkness. And then, as you might guess, The Last Battle is about the end of the world and last judgment and eschatology. So like, he had a sense of it, but as you say, I don't think he started there and said, let me build an outline. Rather, he seemed to have started with a faun in a forest and said, you know what that makes right. me think of, and then ends up doing something that's clearly Christian because he thinks like a Christian.
Right.
Well, I think this does get to the heart of what Lewis is doing as a fiction writer. In the metaphor that he used that Alistair McGrath takes up in his biography of Lewis is a spectacle versus a pair of spectacles. You can study the Chronicles of Narnia as a spectacle in and of itself, something to look at, something to study, something to enjoy. But beyond that, actually, the Chronicles of Narnia and all of Lewis's fiction, in fact, it's probably more overt in the Space Trilogy that he's doing this, is that his fiction is a pair of spectacles through which to look at the world. And so McGrath says, we can look at the sun itself, or we can look instead of what it illuminates, thus enlarging our intellectual, moral, and aesthetic vision. We see the true, the good, and the beautiful more clearly by being given lenses that bring them into focus. They are not invented by our reading of Narnia, but they are discerned, lit up, and broadened to sharper focus. And more than that, we see more and we see farther by looking through the right lenses. I think that kind of captures what we've been discussing is what is Lewis trying to do? He's trying to take something that he sees and then help us see it even better. Whether that's these themes in the Narnia books or what these characters are like in human nature, whether it's the reinterpretation of the creation story, you know, and some of the kind of bizarre twists in the Space Trilogy that help us to see reality or at least think about reality even differently. I was trying to distill this down into a couple of different words that describe what the impact of Lewis's fiction are. And the first one that I came up with was enchantment. And one of the reasons I thought about this is in Alec Jacobs' book, which is called The Narnian. He organizes the whole book around this theme of enchantment. In fact, he writes, Lewis's mind was above all characterized by a willingness to be enchanted, and that it was this openness to enchantment that held together the various strands of his life, his delight in laughter, his willingness to accept a world made by a good and loving God, and in some ways above all, his willingness to submit to the charms of a wonderful story. What do you guys think about that and, you know, the word enchantment to describe Lewis's life, but also his fiction?
I would definitely go with that. And I'll give you one example. One of the reasons, anticipating my answer later to what's my favorite, but I do like the Narnia series for this reason. He opens up an entire enchanting world. And I want to compare it to something else that I like, Harry Potter. Harry Potter is not an enchanting world. It is a group of people that come into the existing world and do different things. And it's a delightful story. I'm not bashing Harry Potter, but there's a big difference here. This whole world is enchanting. And so to me, that really resonates with me, because one of the things I liked about the world of Narnia that he created is its inherent enchantment because of the creatures that live there and what happens there.
Philosopher Charles Taylor talks about the difference between the modern secular age and the ages that preceded it. And one of the big words he uses is that we have a buffered reality, that the material world that we experience is disconnected from any sort of spiritual reality. If a spiritual reality exists, it's on the other side of the wall and is of no pertinence to our world. We live in a disenchanted world. C.S. Lewis, again, student of medieval everything and ancient literature, lived and thought in this enchanted way. It helps us recapture that by opening the porous boundaries. It's something he definitely gained from his study in medieval literature. When you read The Divine Comedy by Dante, it just makes sense to someone like Dante that you could just travel through hell and purgatory up through heaven like you do through Europe, because they were the same sorts of places. When you read Milton, Earth is described as on the frontier of heaven, like a colony. They have kind of spatial and geographical significance that it's part of the same universe, not cordoned off somewhere. And so all of that, I think, influences Lewis in his way of thinking of the world as enchanted. And so he invites us into that. When you read the Space Trilogy, you travel off into space and find out we just lived on the boring planet. Actually, the whole spiritual realm is integrated in space once you get out of our little pocket, our silent planet, that it's been alive and well all along. And he's inviting you to think about the world in an enchanted way.
Ben, that really resonates with me. I love your bringing in Taylor's buffered reality and the buffered self, and the idea that we live, and this is one reason I think Lewis is as popular today as he is, having been set so long ago in time and in a different kind of world of World War II. But I think he's popular today because we do live in an impoverished little world. And to borrow from James K.A. Smith, he talks about when you look at the worldview of our world, there are cracks in it. And one way to think about Lewis is he shows us what happens if you look through the cracks and see something bigger. So coming all the way around, Cole, I think you're choosing the word enchantment here is really incisive.
Well, to come back to enchantment and children, as you guys are saying, it's easy as adults to kind of just get in with the tide of our buffered selves and our disenchanted world. I think that James K. Smith quote has always resonated with me when he talks about the iron ceiling, or whatever he talks about, the dome that is over our reality. Mm-hmm. And what Lewis is doing is actually not trying to re-enchant the world. He's trying to pull the veil back on what the world is really like. And that's where something like The Great Divorce, for example, I think is such a powerful book. In some ways, I don't know that I would argue this down to the T, but in some ways, The Great Divorce is the most similar of his books to something like apocalyptic literature. So, Ben, as you mentioned earlier, apocalyptic literature is not allegory, although it might contain some of that. But what it's doing is describing the real world that we can't actually see. That's what Lewis is doing in The Great Divorce. Is I think people maybe miss the point of that book sometimes when they talk about, is this really what heaven and hell are like? You know, is hell really this city where everybody's just spread out and, you know, Napoleon is at the very edge or whatever it is? No. What it's trying to do, it's kind of like apocalyptic literature in the sense that it's actually showing us what's real in a way that we can see it, pulling the veil back on what's really there. And I love this G.K. Chesterton quote that captures a lot of what both Tolkien and Lewis were doing. He says, "Fairy tales do not tell children that dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. Fairy tales tell children that dragons can be killed." And I love that quote because that's really what Lewis is doing. Kids haven't bought in some ways to the way that we see the universe. And so they're more open to seeing it as it is, where you can have something like, you know, a talking lion who lays his life down. We say, well, lions can't really talk. We've got to find a correlation to what this really means. But in some sense, the lion laying his life down is the truth. That is reality at a deep level. And so what happens for us when we read these books is we are actually guided into seeing the world as it actually is. And there's something so powerful about a fiction writer who can write about what's real in such a potent way.
I agree. I think, you know, as we talk about this, it occurs to me, and I'm not making a parallel between Jesus and C.S. Lewis here, but that's exactly what Jesus was doing. He was doing it in a different way, but you talked about the parables. He's coming and he's not saying, I want to give you a new idea. He says, I actually want to pull the veil back. Like you said, Cole, I want to show you what the world's really like. I want to show you the parts that you can't see. And to that extent, Lewis is using fiction to do something very similar, I think.
There's a sense in which, and I think Lewis says this at one point, he's almost trying to re-paganize the world, that like the pagans saw the world wrong, but the secular man doesn't even see the world. And so by helping us see more of it, then we can say, now here's the way you should see it. But for the modern man, there's so much of the world he doesn't even bother to look at that the fiction created an opening for that.
Yes. And to go back to something that you guys have mentioned earlier, this begins for Lewis with images. And I can't help but think about in Surprise by Joy, this is the way that he describes his experience with Joy, is he was captured by the powerful feelings and emotions that were attached to these images. So one of the things that arrests, the child C.S. Lewis is the idea of fall. You know, that's something that just captivates him, or Balder the Beautiful who is dead, or, you know, these, it's not just the stories, it's this potent image. And after the Chronicles of Narnia, Lewis writes an essay called It All Began with a Picture, just a very short, it's actually just like a page long, where he talks about the beginning of the Chronicles of Narnia. And he says, all my 7 Narnia books and my 3 science fiction books begin with seeing pictures in my head. At first, they were not a story, just pictures. The Lion, you know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe all began with a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood. This picture had been in my head since I was about 16. Then one day, when I was about 40, I said to myself, let's try to make a story about it. And interestingly enough, this was the difficult piece for Lewis. He actually has the first couple of paragraphs of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe written very quickly. He reads them to some people. He talks about them with people in 1949. But he's stuck there until, he says later in this essay, and then Aslan comes bounding into the story and pulled the whole story together, and later all 7 of the books together around the central figure of Aslan.
That's a good point, Cole. Aslan, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, is the only character that's in all 7 books. And so he does, you know, pull the story together. And back to our discussion, Ben, about allegory, if he did do something allegorical, he did it backwards, in that he starts with the image and now Aslan comes in to pull everything together.
In his space trilogy, there's an element of that image driving the story. My favorite of the 3 is Perelandra, which is based on his image, an image in his mind formed from the Venus Aphrodite myth. I mean, that he's thinking about that story, which he then puts on the actual planet Venus, and then retells this image of, you know, Aphrodite being born out of the sea, only he gets there and it's Eve, a second Eve, an Eve of Eve as if she had been on Venus. And it's this other story. But it starts out with this image in his head of Aphrodite, the planet Venus, and this kind of concept that he's kicking around. He had a lot of interest in astronomy. A lot of his it's a back of the shelf kind of thing, but there's a lot of planetary references, even outside of his space trilogy, in all of his writings, that he had this notion of cosmology and how that connected with ancient myth that, again, lived in images in his head. And he would sometimes just kind of pluck one out of the air and a story would come out of it.
You know, there's a really interesting book for anybody that wants to go deeper into this called Planet Narnia.
Yeah.
And in it, Michael Ward argues that the planets are actually behind each of the Chronicles of Narnia. And it's not just the planets themselves. It's the ancient understanding of cosmology and myth that went with each of these planets and gods and the things associated with them. And it's fascinating because one of the arguments, or one of the criticisms against the Chronicles of Narnia versus something like The Lord of the Rings, is it's not as methodical, it's not as tight, it's not as consistent. But if you read through Planet Narnia, what you realize is there is a consistency here. There is an amazing sense of a complete world that's not as much connected in terms of genealogies or things like The Lord of the Rings, but in terms of this worldview, this vision, or this connected myth that is in the background. And I think that revolutionized the way that people actually read the Chronicles of Narnia. You're not just like sitting there thinking of Mars and Venus and Mercury the whole time, but you are thinking there's something distinctly thematic about the way these books are written that correlate with a broader scheme of understanding the universe.
He does something that I think you'll even point out in probably your next major theme, is that Lewis is really good at show versus tell. That, again, because it starts with an image, he may have an argument he wants to make or a concept, but he's going to show it to you rather than tell you. So you can read the whole series and not think, here he's going to talk about Venus. You know, you're not thinking right. Planets, but it's clearly demonstrated in the work. And having dabbled a little bit in fiction writing, I'm not any good at it. That's so hard to have a concept and not just telegraph it to the reader, but demonstrate it. I know there's a great quote from J.K. Rowling, who talked about the struggle. Whenever she had something complicated to say, she needed some exposition, she would just have Hermione Granger say it, because Hermione is everything, right? That it was hard to do world building without a narrator to say, and now here's what's going on. And Lewis kind of just does that really well.
You know, one question I have for you guys is, if you think about now, we've talked about how this came about, you know, from a picture, he enters an enchanted world. You have the question of, what are some of the key themes in this? And what I mean by that is, the more typical themes you might see in lasting literature like this is that it talks about the battle between good and evil. It talks about power and inverting power, or it talks about right and wrong, or goodness, and you know, some of the key themes and ideas of humanity. But what kinds of themes like that show up in his fiction writing?
Lewis has a sense, almost intuitive, of the shape that fiction can take. And so in mythology, there are just trajectories that good stories take. And that's, as we've talked about in other podcasts, he came to believe those were true trajectories, true arcs, with false information, as it were, but that Christianity was the truth of that. And so you see those trajectories, and that may be what you mean by themes, in so many of his writings, the idea of substitution, of Aslan dying on behalf of someone and being conquering death. In his mind, that's just the shape of the universe. That's the way any good story should go. And it's definitely the story of Jesus. It's true. So that theme plays out. He definitely has a hierarchical view of the universe, the idea of there being kings and royalty and kingdoms, doesn't offend his sensibility. He's even a bit complementarian when you get to that hideous strength. I mean, he has an idea of, like, yeah, there's a shape to society that's supposed to happen. And he just distills that in his books so well. And there are a lot of those themes of just, this is the way the world is in his mind. And they just kind of drop down into his literature.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. He has a shape for fiction, and he understands a shape of the world, and those two actually correlate with each other. And I think one of the things in the Chronicles of Narnia, especially, is the writing is, for being very short, it is still pretty complex. You have complex characters, which is sometimes the criticism against Christian fiction, is everything is just too neat and tidy. Lewis is able to write complex characters, as is Tolkien, but he's also able to present a morally coherent universe. Good is good and bad is bad, and the characters know the difference. They don't always do that, but that's what makes it very human. That's what makes it complex. But you're never wondering, and this is maybe the difference between a lot of modern, or maybe we'd say postmodern fiction, is there is a discernible morality and ethic in the universe in Lewis's fiction, just like there is in The Lord of the Rings. And the characters are real enough in that struggle to identify with, but they're not so confused that you can't figure out who's good, who's evil, what's right, what's wrong.
Cole, I think that's a really key point. And for me, it's one of the things that made me love his fiction, is sometimes when you're trying to express your worldview, or you're trying to make a point, you know, there's good in the world, there's evil in the world, your characters become very one-dimensional. They're either all good, or they're all evil. And of course, he's living in a time, which I could almost forgive him of that. We have to remember, he's face to face with the evil of Nazism and Hitler. And it was a world that was all good, all evil, because the contrast was so stark. And yet his characters are real people. They're not all good, or at least not all the time. And, you know, there's a little bit of sympathy, you know, for the bad. In other words, they come across as really three-dimensional characters.
Mm-hmm. Best example of this and of moral development is in Till We Have Faces, which is probably not one of his best known, but might be his best fiction. It's for him a retelling of Cupid and Psyche. And of course, he's got all his mythology back there. But it's the moral development of one woman who, I'm drastically oversimplifying, but she hides her face because her father tells her she's ugly and she wears a veil. It turns out she's also, even though she's the main character, there's something about her that's ugly on the inside too, that her love is not a good love. She consumes things she loves. She damages things she loves. And then through the story, she develops and she's hostile. She's angry at the gods because they're distant from her. But at the end, she removes the veil and it turns out she is lovely. And she's been transformed. And now, because her face is clearly seen, she can see what the gods are doing. And so it's this sense of moral development throughout the story, even in the main character, who's not perfectly and unimpeachably good. In fact, she has desperate flaws that she and you as the reader have to discover as you go, is a huge theme in Lewis's writings. His notion... We might struggle with this theologically, but he would not put soteriology, salvation and sanctification in ironclad, hermetically sealed containers. For him, that there's this moral development throughout life and even into eschatology. In Mere Christianity, he talks about people in heaven will say, we've been there all along, that like you're being transformed into God's people. And you just get there by virtue of the story that God is writing.
Ben, what you described there is a great illustration of what this third word is, which is argument. That Lewis is actually, he's making the case for things through his fiction. He's making a case about the way sanctification works, you know, making a case for the way that people develop and fatal flaws and all this kind of thing. And what's interesting, though, is I've never found the Chronicles of Narnia to feel preachy. Some of that is because I agree with the underlying message that he's sending.
Right.
But if you read fiction that's coming out today, much of it is so preachy, it's hard to stomach. And I say this as a person who doesn't read much fiction. And this is one of the reasons is I'd rather just read your nonfiction case for whatever it is that you're trying to say, as opposed to this kind of not so cleverly disguised story telling me what you really wanted me to know anyway. I don't get that sense with Lewis, though. And with some of the other writers in this era, they're clearly trying to make arguments, but they're not doing it in a way that's quite so on the nose. There's still an enjoyment and a wonder attached to it. And I came across this quote this week. It's from J.I. Packer, and it's in a little essay that he wrote for Christianity Today called Still Surprised by C.S. Lewis. And he says the enduring appeal of Lewis is the blend of logic and imagination, that all of his arguments are illustrations in the sense that they throw light directly on realities of life and action, while all his illustrations are arguments in the sense that they throw light directly on realities of truth and fact. That is a brilliant characterization of what makes Lewis such a great fiction writer, is on the one hand, his illustrations, his fantasy, all of this is able to throw light on real life, you know, has the zest of life in it. And on the other, he's actually able through these illustrations to talk about truth and fact in these arguments. He's actually presenting you with something about the real world.
And his modern imitators don't do it as well, whether they be Christian or non-Christian, but I would say especially non-Christian. So I'm a Disney Plus subscriber, and I love Star Wars and Marvel and all the great stories of the modern age, and I like to share them with my kids. But I'll say my 14-year-old son the other day, not a C.S. Lewis scholar and not a literature professor, he said, Do you think Disney will ever make something that's not like shoving a social idea down my throat? And his point was that like the propaganda is not necessarily subtle, and we enjoy the stories, and yet it's kind of like it, as you say, it feels preachy, and a lot of modern cultural products are preachy, and modern Christians can have the same fault. Whereas Lewis just did it so well, where you enjoy the story, you learn something in it, and you thought about something in a new way that you didn't have to accept, but at least you now saw it as credible, that you saw something illustrated that you hadn't seen before, and did it in a way that you didn't feel dirty afterwards, that you had something had been sold to you. You had been tricked into something at the end of the story. It was just like, oh, that's a believable story. I like that. I don't know if it's true, but I like the way it went. He did that really well.
Yeah, it comes back to that metaphor that we talked about earlier, is if the fiction then is putting on a pair of spectacles, it's not just that you're looking at it anymore and the distinct message that it's presenting. It's that it's presenting something to you in such a way that now you're looking at the world through it. And that's part of the difference is, all fiction is pointing towards something. Some of it is very self-referential. Some of it is allegorical, pointing to, you know, a specific event. But most of it is in the middle. It is presenting you with something in and of itself, but it's also presenting itself to you as a way of seeing the world. And I think what Lewis does so well in his fiction is he sides on the pair of spectacles. There's obviously a lot to look at in the Chronicles of Narnia, the Space Trilogy, and these other works that he's done. But more than that, once you step into that world, you can't help but look at our world the same way ever again. Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.